Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. It's fun to be back at the Boston Book Festival. This is our panel. It's called Readings, Great New England Reads. We're going to hear from each of our authors. I will introduce them, each of them, then they will read from their books a bit, talk, and then we will leave room at the end for Q&A, so be thinking about your questions. I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Robin Call, and I have been connecting readers and writers for many years through my Reading with Robin podcast events and also monthly author series that I host with my daughter Emily called The Cardigan Connection in Providence on Third Tuesdays. So first up, we have Carla Negger. She is the New York Times bestselling author of more than 75 novels, including a popular Sharp and Donovan suspense series. Her books have been translated into dozens of languages and sold in more than 35 countries. An active member of the writing community, Carla is a founding member of the New England chapter of Romance Writers of America and has served as president of Novelists Inc. and vice president of International Thriller Writers. In addition to writing, Carla has taken up running, having recently completed the Covered Bridges Half Marathon in Vermont several times, as well as the Dingle Half Marathon in Ireland. Frequent travelers, especially to Ireland, she lives with her husband in Vermont and has two grown children and three young grandchildren in the Boston area. Welcome, Carla.
Thank you very much. We're going back to Ireland tomorrow night, so I might or might not be a little, you know, what am I doing? I'm going to do a reading today from Rivals Break, which is my latest Sharp and Donovan novel. It's the ninth book in the series, and featuring FBI agents Emma Sharp and Colin Donovan. She's an art crimes expert, and he's primarily an undercover agent, and they're from Maine, they're based in Boston, so there's a lot of New England, but there's also an Ireland connection to the series. So when you dive in to the ninth book in the series, there's a lot of characters because there's their family and friends, and they do live adventurous lives. So the story starts with Emma and Colin coming back to their home in Maine on the coast for what's supposed to be a quiet weekend for his brother Andy's wedding. And Declan's Cross, they get in Andy and Julianne, who he's marrying, they get in trouble in Declan's Cross, the third book in the series. So I will start, just dive right in here. They're at the wedding. Julianne and Andy chose to have their wedding at the old sea captain's house the Donovans had converted into an inn out on the harbor. Emma couldn't imagine a more perfect day for the hometown pair. The bright, clear autumn weather continued through last night's rehearsal and the wedding, held outside on the inn's expansive lawn, with colorful leaves reflected in the quiet water and coordinating with Julianne's golden brown hair and warm white dress. The Donovans and Maronis had simple tastes and a modest budget, but they knew how to have a good time. Even gloomy Franny Maroney, Julianne's widowed grandmother, couldn't find much to complain about. Beautiful wedding, she said next to Emma at the cake table. Her white hair in tight, neat curls, she wore a flowing burgundy dress and sturdy shoes. At 75, she was a bundle of energy. She sighed, eyeing the rows of cake slices on small plates. No Donovans and tuxes, though. Andy nixed them. I think Julianne was in on it, though. Emma smiled. Disappointed, are you? I'm not the only one. We had powder blue tuxes at my wedding. It was at the church. It seems like yesterday. Weddings bring back memories. Have you had cake yet? I tried all three kinds. That's my plan, too. Unable to decide on just one cake, Andy and Julianne had opted for three, coconut, apple spice, and chocolate. There were autumn-decorated cookies, too, but Emma had to draw the line at overindulging somewhere. Franny wandered off, and Emma helped herself to a small slice of the apple spice cake. Maybe she'd stop there after all, or maybe she wouldn't. Connor was out the outdoor bar, looking sexy in his dark suit as he engaged what appeared to be an intense conversation with his youngest brother, Kevin, a state Marine patrol officer. Another moment, Colin started across the yard to her. Kevin's heading out to check on possible food poisoning at a yacht party. I'd like to tag along. Okay with you? Of course. He looks like he'd appreciate the company. He's miserable. He's feeling sorry for himself because he came to the wedding alone. Emma grabbed a fork for her cake. He's the only unattached brother. He's also the youngest. I told him he could have brought his dog. No one would have minded. And he was unamused. Very. Was he as rough on you when you were unattached? Rougher. Emma was getting used to the banter between the brothers. She'd rarely seen it go too far, but she imagined sometimes it did. Not that anything would ever break the bond between them. The Donovans were a tight-knit lot. In their own way, so were the Sharps, but now it was just herself, her grandfather, her brother, and her mother. Kevin's trying not to inflict himself on the rest of us, Colin added cheerfully. Drunken partiers puking off the sun deck of a fancy yacht will give him perspective. Lovely, Emma said. Wear gloves and a mask and a gown. Maybe goggles, too. Kevin's got gear in his truck, but I'm letting the medical types deal with any bodily fluids. Fun talk at a wedding, isn't it? You're a good brother. I'll save you and Kevin cookies. Save us a good Irish whiskey instead. He crossed the lawn to join Kevin, already at his truck on the narrow outer harbor road. Colin had started in law enforcement with the State Marine Patrol. He'd know the drill, not that either of them needed to respond. But Emma loved seeing how relaxed he was so soon after a weeks-long deep cover mission. As she ate her cake with its not too sweet cream cheese frosting, she noticed Finian Bracken, the Irish priest and friend who'd officiated the wedding, peel away from several guests and walk toward her. In his late 30s, blue-eyed and handsome with angular features and dark hair, he'd also officiated at her and Colin's wedding in June. Emma, Finian said, kissing her cheek, it's good to see you. Across the yard, Andy swept his bride into his arm and started up the front steps in the sprawling early 19th century house. They'll be at the cottage in time for lunch tomorrow, Finian said, obviously pleased. Emmy knew he was referring to the traditional Irish stone cottage he owned in the Kerry Hills with stunning views of Kenmare Bay. He seldom, if ever, stayed there, given the bittersweet memories it held of his wife and two young daughters who died in a sailing accident 8 years ago, a tragedy that ultimately led him to Rock Point. He looked preoccupied as Emma set her cake plate on a stack of other empty plates. I'm finished here, he said. Why don't we drive to the rectory together? I could use your opinion on something. She eyed him. He obviously didn't want to provide details. Sure, let's grab a few cookies. She placed a dozen cookies in the boxes set out for that purpose and followed Finian to his BMW, the one obvious symbol of his past as a successful whiskey man, owner, with his twin brother Declan of Bracken Distillers back home in Ireland. It was just a few minutes' drive to the rectory. And he said little before parking at the homely vinyl-sided Greek Revival house that served as a rectory for St. Patrick. Sorry about that. Rock Point's struggling and only Roman Catholic church. The small granite-faced church was next door to the rectory, a short walk from the house Emma shared with Colin. As she got out of the car, she saw what had prompted Finian's troubled mood and his invitation to join him. More specifically, who? Henrietta Balfour stood in the middle of the rectory's front walk, twirling a red leaf by the stem, her reddish curls pulled back loosely with a large clip, looking more like the garden designer Finian would know her as than the MI5 officer she was. Behind Henrietta, Oliver York looked on from the front steps. Tawny-haired and green-eyed, he was a mythologist, a gentleman farmer, a former art thief, and lately an MI5 asset. They were all friends after a fashion. Henrietta greeted Emma with her infectious smile. What a stunning day for my first visit to Maine. I love the sea air this time of year. We left a dreary rain in London. She shifted her attention to Finian as he started up the walk. Do you rake the leaves once they've fallen or just leave them on the ground through winter? We rake. I should say volunteers from the church rake. Emma pinned her gaze on her priest friend. What's going on, Finian? Henrietta and Oliver are here for a visit. Oliver texted me as Julianne and Andy were cutting the cake. We didn't want to distract you and Colin from the wedding, Henrietta said. We hopped on a plane and here we are. Sometimes one needs to do things at the spur of the moment. Henrietta nodded to the box Emma had tucked in one arm. I hope that's the wedding cake. Cookies, Emma said. Cookies then, brilliant. Shall we put the kettle on? Oliver picked up his and Henry's bags by the steps. Where's your charming husband, Emma? Colin had warmed up to Oliver in the past year, but it was a stretch to call them friends. He's checking on food poisoning aboard a yacht in Heron's Cove. Just the slightest flicker in Oliver's eyes, but it was enough to arouse Emma's suspicions. Henrietta, on the other hand, didn't give anything away. And then, of course, the food poisoning is connected to the MI5, and off we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carla. Next up, you got your glasses? Okay. Next up, Lisa Duffy is the author of The Salt House, named by Real Simple as a best book of the month upon its June release, as well as Bustle's 17 best debut novels by women in 2017, and This Is Home, a Publisher's Weekly starred review novel and 2019 favorite book club pick. Her third novel, My Kind of People, is forthcoming in June of 2020 from Atria. Lisa received her MFA in creative writing from the University of Massachusetts. Her writing can be found in numerous publications, including Writer's Digest. She's the founding editor of Roar, a literary journal supporting women in the arts. Lisa lives in the Boston area with her husband and her three children. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival stage.
Thank you. So I managed to lose my cheaters in like the 30-yard walk from the hospitality room to here, and this lovely woman lent them to me. So if I stumble when I'm reading, you'll know why. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about, sort of split my time and talk about a little bit about how the book came about, and then do a reading with whatever time I have left. So this book, I started writing this book before my debut novel even really hit the shelves. It takes about a year for your publishing company to sort of get a book out the door, and that's usually when you turn to your second, you know, or third or fourth book, whatever you're writing. My debut novel is called The Salt House, and it centers around a child that's passed away, and it's told in four different alternating perspectives from each member of the family. So when my agent came to me and said, sort of, what are you thinking about, we didn't know how the book was going to be received. It ended up being received sort of the way that we had hoped it would, and that it was seen as a hopeful story, not just some downer. It was about, you know, faith and love and family sort of being able to transcend even the most unimaginable loss. But we didn't know that at this time. What we did know is that when we went to editors to sell the book at the different publishing houses, there were a couple editors who refused to even open the first page, not one page. And to be fair, these editors were young mothers. I think one of them was pregnant. And they basically just said, you know, I don't really have the headspace to deal with this topic right now. And so that's what we knew. And so my agent, when she said, you know, what are you thinking about writing? I didn't really have any idea. I'm not a plotter. I sort of have to play with characters and really just see where things go. And so I said, I'm not really sure. And my agent is this sort of, this very elegant woman. Everything comes out like very nice, even when it's not nice. Very different from sort of how I say things. So she very nicely said to me, okay, so when you're thinking about this next book, how about you write something where like an editor wants to open the first page as opposed to not wanting to open the first page. So the very first stirrings of this book was me trying not to harm a small child, was really where it started. So when I started writing, the first voice that really I wanted to follow was Libby Winters. So Libby Winters in this book is a 16-year-old girl who lives in the middle of an apartment of a triple-decker in Paradise, Massachusetts, which is a fictional town north of Boston. That's really nothing like Paradise. It's an income-diverse town, and Libby's sort of on the lower end of the income diversity. And she lives with her father, Bentley, and he's a policeman in the town. And they've recently moved into this triple-decker with Libby's two aunts living above her. And the story really starts when she's talking about sort of how crowded and noisy this triple-decker is. And to make matters worse, there's a woman who's moved in downstairs, a stranger. And so the stranger, I knew at that time I was sort of working with Libby to her voice. I was really adding a lot of stuff into the story that was from my own childhood. I grew up 12 miles outside of Boston in a triple-decker, middle apartment. We always had family living with us. And so I was sort of following her voice, but I wasn't really sure where it was going until this character came along who moved in downstairs. And the person that moves in downstairs is Quinn Ellis. And she is a she's the wife of a soldier who's just returned from Iraq from his second tour. And he's suffering from PTSD that he refuses to acknowledge. And after a violent night terror, he disappears. And she subsequently ends up living in the first floor apartment of this triple decker, as Bent is her husband's former platoon leader. And that's where really the story started to come together for me. Because although I was taking stuff from my own childhood for Libby, Quinn, I really knew at that time that I really wanted to write about the service. And it was really just an event that happened in my own life. My oldest daughter had graduated from high school, and she came home one day and told me a couple of her friends, really, were joining the service. And my reaction was really just like a huge parenting fail. I was immediately sort of, I reacted sort of with fear and anxiety. Like, well, you know, just fear for these kids who I knew. And they weren't just joining, you know, maybe in intelligence positions. They were, you know, potentially going into combat. And so I, you know, sort of challenging her a little bit, saying, like, you know, why would they make this choice? And she, rightly so, came back at me and said, well, this is a really honorable thing, and they really have a lot of pride in what they do. But I thought at that point, it was sort of a jumping off point for me. You know, anytime you're going to spend a year or two with a book, you really want to come at it from a place of curiosity, of learning, of, you know, trying to understand something. And so for me, I didn't know anybody in the military. My dad served in the National Guard, but I was very young. And, you know, I don't think he ever left Massachusetts. I think it was a weekend, you know, here and there, 2 weeks. And we never really even talked about it again. And so that was the point for me that I really wanted to sort of investigate, you know, how does it change your life? How does it change the life of the person who's staying at home? How does it change your trajectory together as you go through this life? And, you know, what happens maybe when somebody comes home suffering, and how do you then go forward? So that was really where the book started. So I think I'll read, I'm just going to start really at the beginning. There's a prologue, which is in Quinn's voice, and then the first chapter, which is that 6 minutes left? Yay. Okay. Okay. So I'll just read. Can you just tap me? Because, like, when I get close.
Okay.
All right.
How hard?
That's hard. Like, don't shove me off the chair, but, like, okay. Yeah, right. After John left, Quinn would lie awake at night and picture the look of shock on his face, the way he had woken up from the nightmare and stared at her as if she were a stranger in the bed next to him instead of his wife, the woman he'd known since they were kids, teenagers with dreams and hopes, wants and desires. Perhaps her look mirrored John's. He'd come home from the war a different person, a stranger to her, someone she moved around carefully, gently, as if he were a bomb ready to explode. Of course, there was the PTSD, a medical explanation for what Quinn thought of in simpler terms, an imaginary switch inside John's body that flipped suddenly and without warning and lit up the spaces inside of him that were dark and wounded and afraid. Quinn thinks of the days when they were first married and she was pregnant with twins. She'd picked out names even though she was only in her first trimester. Matthew and Michael Ellis for boys, Michelle and Melissa Ellis for girls. She'd choose somehow if they got one of each, but only the M mattered. Me and me is what they called each other, their initials. They think it was a coincidence, but she had planned it, dreamed it. Imagine coming into the world with someone who looks like you, someone who fills the space next to you as you grow. When Quinn miscarried in the 11th week, she told John she couldn't imagine anything more devastating in this life. Looking back now, she thinks of how naive she'd been, how wrong. The sound of a trumpet fills the air around her. A folded flag is handed to her by a man dressed in a uniform, but under his cap, she sees the smooth skin of his face, the wisp of hair on his upper lip, and she realizes he's just a boy just like John had been. She wants to take off his cap, loosen his tie, smooth the hair back from his forehead. She wants to tell him to take off that uniform, to give her that damn gun. She wants to lean forward and whisper in his ear, run. Instead, she takes the flag and presses it against her chest to keep her heart from slipping out. Libby. The year I turned 10, my father shot the above-ground pool in our backyard with his police-issued pistol. I don't remember it, but I hear about it all the time. My father likes to tell the story at the bowling alley bar when all eyes are on him. There's usually wild turkey over ice in the glass in front of him, or maybe a bottle of beer, sometimes both. The story gaining speed with every sip. The guys egging him on, all of them off-duty cops, remembering the fall cookout in my backyard. My mother in the kitchen with the other girlfriends and wives and the men outside in rusty lawn chairs watching my father scowl at the eyesore of a pool taking up space on his newly purchased property. Stagnant water the color of tree bark sat high against the rim, and the entire structure leaned off center, and someone called out, "Jesus Christ, that thing's a damn cesspool Tower of Pisa." The scumful pool had come with the house, and my father hated it. None of the guys remember who first joked about pumping it full of bullets to empty the water, but they all remember my father standing up, taking two steps forward, and drawing his weapon. They say he shot that gun as if he were a cowboy in an old Western film, quick draw and from the hip, firing until he ran out of bullets, and the pool was a wheel of Swiss cheese, dirty water spurting from every hole. The story always ended the same. The telling of it might veer in different directions, but the ending always looped back to my father saying, "Who is going to stop me? I'm in the biggest gang in town." The year my father shot the pool, I got out of bed most nights at midnight to sit with him when he got off work. That was 6 years ago, and my mother always said I was too young to be up that late. But my father never sent me back to bed. He'd drink a beer, eat a turkey sandwich, lettuce, tomato, mayo, potato chips smashed between the bread, his gun belt on the table between us. "My night owl," he'd say as I slid into the chair across from him, just like me. Back then, you could slice our family crosswise like a sandwich. My mother on one side, olive-skinned, quiet and distant. My father and I, fair-skinned, restless and temperamental. Then half of that sandwich disappeared. Cancer took my mother away pound by pound and then breath by breath. Then the medical bills piled in and our house went up for sale. We moved into the middle apartment in Aunt Lucy's triple-decker after that, when we had no place to live. 1 minute, okay. Exactly. Now it's just me and Rooster Cogburn and my father, Bentley, who everyone calls Bent, which suits him. We got Rooster Cogburn from the shelter. He ended up there after the police were called to his house for a domestic dispute. Bent was the one who showed up and dealt with the mess and then brought him to the shelter. When months went by and no one wanted Rooster, Bent took him home because he was a guard dog if he'd ever seen one. The vet said she'd never seen a lazier dog, but Ben ignored her, and now we have a 97-pound mutt who never gets off the couch. He sleeps on his back with his legs in the air like he's been shot. He's no guard dog either. I've heard him bark a handful of times, and even then it sounds like a bored half-yawn type of thing. Rooster and I go for a walk a couple times a day. Yay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You'll have to read it to find out what happens. It's a good place. And now we have Randy Susan Myers' fifth novel, Wasted, tackles the personal and political, body image and fat shaming. Parade Magazine, Pop Sugar, BookBub, Women.com, Get Literary, and Brit.com chose Wasted as a top 2019 summer read. Three of Myers' novels were chosen as a must-read book by the Massachusetts Council of the Book, an affiliate of the Library of Congress. Randy is a Brooklyn-Boston mix. Right?
Shout out to Brooklyn.
Brooklyn-Boston mix, who believes happiness requires family, friends, books, and an occasional New York bagel. She lives in Boston with her husband, where she teaches writing seminars at Boston's Grub Street Writer Center. She also teaches at Northampton's Writer in Progress. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, I hope you can all hear me. Can you hear me? Yeah, I used to be a bartender. Everybody can hear me. Thank you, Robin. You know I love you. Thank you, Boston Book Festival. And thank you, libraries. I was raised, yes? I don't know if anybody else was raised by a library. If it hadn't been for the Brooklyn Public Library, I would be a heroin addict. It's true. So I just like to tell the truth. So I'm going to talk a little, read a little, talk a little. I like to structure things, okay? So Wasted is the scariest book I've ever written. And I've explored domestic violence, affairs, traumatic brain injury, even Ponzi schemes. I write very lighthearted things. But Wasted was the one that terrified me. The first line of my novel, "Everyone Hates a Fat Woman, But None More Than She Hates Herself," reverberated in me for years. But I kept the words locked away, not wanting to face my own lifelong battle with food. My mother and my sister were model thin. I was not. My mother stashed cookies on the tallest cabinet, and even in our tiny Brooklyn apartment, we had a tall cabinet, and I learned to be a mountain climber. And then I would take those cookies that I worked so hard for and hide them in the hamper, the bottom of the hamper, and then go later eat them secretly. So I'm quite the foodie. I still remember the phone calls my mother asked me from when she moved to Florida. Every time she called me, it was the same question. "So how's your weight?" As though my weight were this thing separate from me, like a little roly-poly puppy, you know, like, "Come on, come here, wait. I stumbled into memories of an uncle as I was standing over the casket of my wonderful, wonderful Aunt Thelma, and she had suffered years of dialysis before dying. And Uncle Seymour, may I never see him again, turned to me and said, "What a shame." And I nodded and goes, "She used to be so beautiful. Look how much weight she gained. A corpse, right?" He's talking about my aunt's corpse. And then, to make things especially fun, he turned to me and he said, "You better be careful." So you know why I don't want to see Uncle Seymour again. In Wasted, Alice and Daphne, seemingly so different, those are my two point of view characters. One is from Mission Hill. She's mixed race, her father is black from Georgia, her mother is white from Brooklyn, and she runs a community center in Mission Hill. And Daphne, who comes from Chestnut Hill, she's a makeup artist, and her family owns a chain of jewelry stores. You would think that maybe Alice, Daphne was me. I only wish my family owned jewelry stores. Actually, Daphne is aspirational me, Alice is more me. They're both successful working mothers, accomplished and seemingly steady. They harbor the same secret. Obsession with their weight overshadows all concerns about their children, husbands, work, and everything else of importance in their lives. Scales terrify them. Both are so damaged from fat shaming, they willingly leave. And by the way, these women are not like joining the circus. They're just like us, you know what I mean? Average, you go up, you go down, but it doesn't matter here in America. They're so damaged from fat shaming, they willingly leave their family and jobs for over a month to take part in a project they think will provide a magic bullet. When reality hits that they're caught in a cruel experiment, we see how far they'll go to lose weight and if they can rescue themselves from the craziness that weight torture brings. Here are a few pages from an early scene where Daphne, desperate to find a dress to wear to her sister's wedding, confronts the fitting room. Anybody here ever had a bad time in a fitting room? Blink your eyes. There Daphne stood, stupidly hunting for a sister of the bride dress without help. Some moments you didn't want witnessed by a friend, but now, held captive by a twig of a sack saleswoman, intent on drowning her in bags of formless cloth, her decision seemed utterly senseless. Daphne wanted only to look attractive, perhaps, God willing, classic, at her sister's wedding, as she told the young woman, but the twig treated her as impossible to prettify, bringing her only disguises. No shock that. The only surprise was how Daphne could forget for even a moment the lesson learned at her mother's knee. Fat women repulsed the world. Daphne had even stooped to using the word slimming when describing the dress she wanted, which perhaps the woman heard as, "Bring me a swath of camouflage." Why else would the twig, young, exquisite, and wrapped in a bandage, give a pseudo-smile and hold up that gruesome mauve outfit? Anyone. And most particularly, someone calling herself a trained occasion associate would know that you never put redheads in mauve. As a side dish to the color's insult, a shade heralding 10 years to assisted living, there was the outfit shapeless cut. Was the twig too young to understand? must a person cross 30 to learn how easy it was to show kindness? Trust me, this will work well. Twig held the flocked hanger a bit higher and cocked her head to the side, seeming to compare her customer's curves to the width of the dress. Daphne pushed away the outfit, even as she kept hold of the impossibly tight, unzipped black number hanging off her shoulders. Honestly, mauve's not a good color for me. Just try it. Twig eked out a dim smile. The cut will work. Trust me, she repeated. They fought for disownership of the dress, both clutching the mauve fabric many beats past social comfort, pushing and pulling until the twig released the hold and poof. Just like that, Daphne lost the fitting room battle. She reached deep to imitate a woman with confidence. I'll let you know if I need help. The woman dipped her head, thrown back to a world where class differences ruled. Of course. Daphne, ashamed at pulling rank on someone who spent her days schlepping clothes to imperious women with thick wallets, gave a genuine smile. Thank you for finding this. She held up the ugly dress as a peace offering. I sincerely appreciate your help. No problem. Trust me. It's suitable for the occasion. Daphne's chest constricted at meriting no more than suitable for the occasion in the stratum of fashion hierarchy. Not gorgeous or sharp or exciting, not even goddamn pretty. At her sister's painfully elegant wedding, Daphne would wear something appropriate, something perhaps the 90-plus Queen of England would wear. Breathtaking would be left for others. Suitably clad and wearing a stunning shade of lipstick was Daphne's fate. She placed the hanger dress on a hook, a dull cherry lifesaver among the shiny black caviar for which Daphne lusted. She caressed her chosen collection of urbane black dresses, the low-hanging fruit she'd plucked from impeccably aligned racks. Not one of them had zipped. Quietly, careful not to make a cracking sound, she pried a peanut butter cracker from the snack pack in her purse and crammed it into her mouth. Chewing the orange Ritz to a fast pulp, eager to swallow before the twig returned, the rush of mashed carbs and salty, nutty fat soothed her. Who doesn't love a good peanut butter cracker?
Exactly. So now we're going to open up to questions. Is that, yeah? Okay. Thank you very much, Randy, Lisa, and Carla. We're going to open it up to questions. Who has a question? If not, we'll just keep talking. Does anybody have a question? I thought there was an order. Okay, I'm going to ask a question then, because I think, all right, so who's in a book club here? Okay, we love the book club people. So if you're looking for book club picks, these are good book club picks, and the authors will be signing outside afterwards, so you can get copies signed, and also they make the best gifts. I'd like to know, the books that you're reading now, what's a favorite book? What would you recommend? Or what's on your stack to be read?
I just finished two great books, which was very depressing, because you know when you read two great in a row and then you're like, my life is over. And I'm listening to one of my favorite books. So I just finished Testaments by Margaret Atwood, which was spectacular, and Dutch House by Ann Patchett, spectacular. And I'm listening to Lonesome Dove. I always like to listen. I like to listen to books I've already read 500 or 600 times.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, because then you really hear it. So Lonesome Dove is like 25 hours of cleaning time, because that's when I listen to audio when I'm cleaning. My house looks great.
I'm in the middle of Three Women by
Lisa Tadeo.
Lisa Tadeo, which is a fantastic, fantastic book that looks at women's sexuality from a lot of different viewpoints. It's kind of stunning. It's nonfiction, but the way that she does it, I actually was up at like 1 in the morning Googling one of the
things.
Yeah. Mm. And it's like, if you go out and look at what actually happened, it's stunning. Yeah. So that's sort of my heavier stuff. I was recently introduced to an author that I didn't know before named Willie Vlaunton. And I'm enjoying, like, just going through a lot of his books. So that's sort of where I'm.
Thank you. And Carla, what are you taking on your trip to Ireland?
Let's see. Well, I'm reading a book on the geology of Ireland. It's actually really interesting, but that's obviously nonfiction. For fiction, I do both print and download onto my, I have an ancient iPad mini that I use, and my husband just bought a new one, and I really want it. But he, I just finished reading all three books by Jane Harper, starting with The Dry, which I highly recommend. It was just fantastic, and the other two as well. And I'm a big Elizabeth George fan, but I just caught up. And let's see, I have a book by J.T. Ellison and a book by Susan Wiggs, The Oysterville Sewing Circle. So I read across the board, read everything, pretty much, not quite.
Thank you. It's like there's never enough titles. And I will add to that, I saw over there Adrian Broder's new memoir, Wild Game, which is, I can't say enough about it. Randy and I were just talking about it. It's awesome. Do not miss Wild Game. I keep thinking they're talking to us.
I know, I do too.
It's so curious.
I just want to thank you, Lisa. I read This Is Home, and it was so touching.
Thank you.
Character's really well developed. Just the whole flow of the story, I loved it.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. Thank you so much.
So when you guys are doing your research or your writing, and you've got your writing cap on, and then you're just like overwhelmed with so much of the work, what's a favorite distraction besides house cleaning?
Oh, house cleaning?
Well, no, Randy was saying she listens to house. She listens to her audience.
That's not mine.
That's not my distraction. It's my.
You got to do it. I
wrote in my neurosis. Actually, I do find cleaning when I'm really angry is good.
What are you just cleaning there? What was that?
That was my stove.
Okay.
I garden. Gardening is one of my most favorite things to do. Actually, to be honest, reading is my... I breathe and read is sort of equal to me. And the third thing that I do for is... Don't judge me. I paint rocks.
No, they're gorgeous. And I'm glad you brought that up. Follow all of the authors on social media, and your gardens are beautiful, and your rocks. How did you get into rock painting?
I was with my grandchild staying in Vermont, and somebody had a kindness project where you paint a rock, leave a rock, and people take a rock, and I thought that was great. So we got a bunch of rocks, and we started painting them. She was bored in 10 minutes. I treated it like a factory. And now I have my whole garden is bordered with, and my husband comes home sometimes when I've been painting, and he just shakes his head. He comes home for a goes, here at the senior home, we find rock painting is a good distraction for them.
Do you sell them? Can we order rocks painted? Is it like a fundraiser?
I'll make you one.
I want a rock.
I'll make you a rock.
Thank you. You all heard it. I want a rock. No, I was fascinated. I'm glad you brought that up. What do you do, Lisa?
You know, I have three kids, and we just recently... got a black lab puppy.
Aww.
Yeah. So I'm in like the opposite where I feel like I'm not over, like that's the overwhelming. So writing to me, right, like is an escape. I'm still in the stage where I have to, you know, really protect my writing time. And so any time that I get to do it, that's sort of like, you know, the other kid, they're like the distraction and then they're... but if I get, you know, for me, very relaxing thing, you know, my husband and I love to cook, and pretty much every night, you know, we'll make something, and I love to put on, like, Chopped, and just, you know, it's such a cathartic release for me to sort of just, you know, put something, you know, put that on the background and just sort of, you know, we sort of have a nightly, you know, thing that we do and, you know, have a nice dinner. And so, you know, there's the work during the day and stuff like that. And then I would say every night, that's just our release.
How old is the puppy?
How old is he? He's 4.5 months right now.
Oh, you have a puppy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have an office and it's sort of a new office. I've never had an office in my life. And we finished it in May, and we got the puppy in, I think, August. And
perfect
since
time.
Then, yeah, I've had to move my computer out to the middle of the kitchen because he'll eat everything, you know, and you just kind of need to keep an eye on him. So
you do.
You forget. You know, we had puppies actually when the kids were little, but they play with each other and they exhaust each other. And now they're a little bit older, and so they're sort of in and out. And then it's a lot more than I...
So the puppy is enjoying their new office.
Yeah. Oh. Yes. Yeah, that's he's so he's a cutie pie, but we're looking forward to him getting a little bit older.
And Carla?
Well, sometimes I love to write. I absolutely love to write. I look forward to it every time I don't know whether I'm writing by hand or computer. I started as a kid climbing a tree. I grew up in Western Mass. I'd sit up in a tree on my favorite branch and write with a pad and pen. But nowadays, what I love to do is to kind of get out of my head sometimes and be fully present. So I took up running, and you know, my mind will wander, but I try to come back to where I am, and I've started to run these half marathons. Just as fairly recent, I started by running a minute. So, but the other day I was running, and I'm fully present, and there's a dead snake, and I'm fully present, and there's another dead snake, and I'm fully present, and there's broccoli. There's like broccoli. Who throws broccoli out their car window? It was fresh broccoli, little flowerets. And so I like, that's when I went right into my head, because now there's a story in the making, don't you think?
Yeah. How did
dead snakes and broccoli.
Yeah, did they were they related, the dead snakes and the broccoli,
I don't,
in some
I
way?
Don't think so, but they could be. Because, you know, we're going to, like, we could really do something with the broccoli. I understand this is out in the country in Vermont, along a nice, quiet river, and there's just me, and I now, because of the bears, you know, I put on, like, my Dropkick Murphys on my iPhone. Every now and then I throw it on loud instead of with the headphones or something, just to let the bears know, I'm here, don't surprise me. But the broccoli, yep, broccoli.
So. Love that. You just never know where broccoli is going to pop up, do you?
I'm glad George Bush.
Was thinking about that. Remember that broccoli thing? To bring that up, right? We get all those broccoli protesters. We have 3 minutes. So, what's a book? I think about this sometimes because I'm asked a lot of times, because I have a podcast and I interview a lot of writers, and people think I've read everything, which is, of course, as we know, impossible. Sitting here in the library. So, what's a book that you can't believe you have never read? Just anything.
These are the hardest questions.
Sorry. I didn't think I was going to be giving them.
Oh, I've got a list.
It was going to be coming from there.
Books I haven't read.
Well, my book shame that I haven't read. There's so many of the classics I haven't read, but I can't believe that I haven't read Madame Bovary. Honestly, I can totally believe that I haven't read Madame Bovary. I'm making it sound like I've read every classic in the world. Somehow I missed Madame Bovary.
There's time.
I can't get through Moby Dick.
Okay.
So that's a life goal.
Got Madame Bovary, Moby Dick.
Gravity's Rainbow.
Ah.
And I say that not because I really had a mad urge to read Gravity's Rainbow, but because I had a professor who had a mad urge for us all to read Gravity's
That'll Rainbow. Do it sometimes, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Randy and Lisa and Carla. This was so much fun. Thank you, audience.
Thank you all.
And go see the authors. Again, autograph books make the best gifts. And it's you're almost doing holiday shopping, so why not start now? Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.